UK Wine Show number 40, Joel Peterson, the King of Zin. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 40 for the 2nd of March 2007. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're going to be talking to Joel Peterson, the King of Zin. Joel produces around 600,000 cases of Zinfandel a year, and this makes him pretty much the world's biggest producer of Zinfandel. So we'll be talking to Joel later on in the show. Just a quick reminder that fair trade is now in full swing, and don't forget those free wine tastings that are dotted all over the UK. Go to our website, www.ukwineshow.co.uk, and head to show number 39, and there you can find the details about how to get to the different free trade wine tastings in the UK. But next up, we've got the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks very much, Chris. The remains of a prehistoric whale dating back some 5 million years have been discovered on a vineyard in Tuscany. The whale is estimated to be around 33 feet long and has been uncovered on the Castello Banfi estate in Montalcino, which is 18 miles from the sea. However, 5 million years ago, the area was under as much as 82 feet of water and teeming with marine life due to the warm, tropical temperatures. Since then, climate changes have caused the Mediterranean to make a slow retreat to its current location. Talk about unique terroir was the comment of Christina Mariani May, the owner of the vineyard. A rich concentration of marine fossils has long been evident at the wine estate, appearing as white specks against the grey clay soil. And in the past, a shark's tooth and clamshell fossils have been unearthed, but nothing on such a grand scale as a whale. To date, the paleontology team working on the site have uncovered 20 football-sized vertebrae. They believe the whale is a young adult because some of the discs and the vertebrae aren't joined together. Their positioning suggests the animal is pointing uphill towards the castle, and the team are continuing to excavate with the hope of finding the head. The excavations should be completed in a few weeks' time. Next up, the fear of another grape glut in parts of the New World is disappearing. With crop figures way down in both Australia and California, the problem of oversupply looks likely to balance out. Australia's harvest is expected to be the smallest in 7 years and a third smaller than in 2006. This equates to 400 million litres less wine. The severe drought experienced across most of Australia has done much to bring production levels back into balance. Water allocations to growers were restricted and yields have gone down dramatically as a result. If anything, Australia's water scarcity seems to provide a natural balance to the problem of oversupply. Laurie Stanford from the Australian Wine and Brandy Corporation reckons the prospect of a very low-yielding season will be viewed with some relief, as it will allow excess wine stocks to be reduced to more reasonable levels. In California too, crops were down compared to the excessive crush of 2005. This lower level of production looks set to continue because the acreage of grapevines has just about levelled out after 11 years of steady increases. The upshot of this is that California won't be able to produce ever larger crops and sales will have a chance to catch up with supply. And finally in the news this week, a bottle of wine with a portrait of Adolf Hitler on the label has sold at auction for just shy of £4,000. The 1943 vintage Führer Wein was from a collection of bottles that were understood to have been given to Hitler's officers during the Second World War. The bottle of red wine was only expected to fetch between £500 and £800. It attracted worldwide interest when it went under the hammer in Plymouth last week, eventually being sold to an unnamed English collector. And staying with German wine, 60 years ago in March 1947, 500,000 bottles of fine German wine failed to find a buyer because all export arrangements had to be made through the military government. The wine was produced in Koblenz in the French zone of Germany and earmarked for export sales. At the time, the price for these wines were perceived as high. Sparkling wines were quoted at 3 shillings a bottle and still wines at between 3 and 8 shillings. That's it for the news this week. Back over to you, Chris.
Thanks very much for that, Jane. I often get asked by people about really old, expensive wines, you know, are they good to drink? You hear stories of people paying thousands and thousands of pounds for 200, 300, 500-year-old wines. And the question is this wine that good? And the answer is no, It is probably rubbish. Wine is a living product, and it does die. So next time you hear a wino talking about some old geriatric wine that they've tasted, have a listen to the words they're using. Quite often the vocab will be quite different, and they'll talk about the wine being delightfully enticing or some rubbish like that. And they're really just full of waffle, and they're trying to just put a nice spin on it. Because let's face it, if someone's cracked open a 200-year-old bottle of some wine they've spent thousands of pounds for, you're not going to put the boot in. So people tend to talk up old wines. If you're paying a lot of money for a very old bottle of wine hoping it to be good, then you're going to be disappointed. My father-in-law had a bottle of wine that he kept for years and years and years and years, thinking the older the wine, the better the wine will get. In actual fact, it was a pretty average bottle of wine when he bought it, and after 20 years, it tasted appalling. That's not to say that some wines don't age well. Some dessert wines can age beautifully, but even those, once you get up to 100 years, are starting to really lose what they had in their youth. So I wouldn't get too worried about that. So why do people pay such big money for wine? Well, it's because the wine has become less about the product inside and more about what it represents. The person who collected the wine for Adolf Hitler probably collects all sorts of wartime memorabilia, and this is just another thing to add to his collection. Will he drink it? Probably, almost certainly not. It'll lose all value, and why collect something that you're going to destroy? Next up, we've got the interview with Joel Peterson, the King of Zin. Hi, I'm here with Joel Peterson from Ravenswood Wines. Ravenswood Wines are, the biggest producer of Zinfandel in the US, Joel?
Yes, we are the number one producer of Zinfandel in the US, which would probably make us the biggest Zinfandel producer in the universe.
Excellent. And how are you, Joel?
I'm doing great.
Yeah? You're staying over in the UK for a while?
I'm going to be over here for a full week. It's always nice to come over here. I've been over here, I think, for the last 3 years on and off, and it's a great place.
How did you get into wine in the first place?
Well, I was actually taught about wine when I was a fairly small boy. It was probably highly illegal, but my father taught me to taste when I was 10. He had a wine tasting group that met on Friday nights, and he began a wine newsletter. And he was interested in writing about the wines, and he needed a simple language, and he decided that a 10-year-old would have simple words for wine. So we would sit down before his wine tasting on Friday night with 12 wines, and he'd measure the wine into my glass. He was actually a chemist. And so I got measured portions of wine, and then he'd measure all the wine in my spit bucket, and so if the total volumes matched, I could come back to the next tasting. And he'd say, "Well, what does this Chardonnay taste like, son?" And I'd say, "Well, gosh, it tastes kind of like apples." And he'd say, "Well, what kind of apples?" And I wouldn't have, you know, anything to say about apples, and so somewhere along the way we'd have to have an apple tasting. So I was very fortunate in that I got the kind of education. You know, we all learned, of course, to use our eyes, and we learned to use our ears, but very few of us really learned to use our nose or our sense of taste. Mm. And so I got that kind of a training very early. So by the time I was 18, of course, this happened for many Friday nights throughout my life, and by the time I was 18, I really had a very good understanding of wine, mostly European wines, because that's mostly what we were tasting. So, you know, I have to say that it was an interesting introduction. I never really expected to be in the wine business. I went on and got degrees in biochemistry and microbiology and went into the biomedical area.
And now you're making wine. How old were you when you made your first vintage, and when was that?
Well, I made my first vintage in 1976, but I had made the decision to leave research in 1972, so I had to find a winemaker who would teach me how to make wine. And I had, of course, you know, the wine knowledge, and I had the science background. So really learning how to drag a hose from point A to point B and which side of a barrel was up were the things that I had to focus on. Yeah. And so I spent a few years spending all my vacations and all my spare time with a guy named Joe Swan. And in 1976, I made my first wine. I made a whopping 427 cases of wine, and I chose Zinfandel.
And what was the wine called? Was that the Dry Creek Zinfandel?
Yeah, it was a Zinfandel from Dry Creek. It was a vineyard that was nearly 100 years old. It was a vineyard called Vogensen Vineyard, and it was low tonnage and fit all the criteria that I had for good wine.
I read somewhere that it won an award.
It was when we finally released it in 1979. We put it in a competitive tasting with a number of other great Zinfandels, and it went through several iterations, and it ended up being the top wine of Zinfandels that were produced in that particular year. So for a guy that was just releasing his first wine, that was pretty amazing.
Good start.
Yeah, very, start. Very good start.
When did you start Ravenswood Wines?
Oh, well, 1976 was my first vintage, but we didn't actually release that first wine until almost 1979, and that's when I started. Ravenswood essentially was started as a company in 1979, really. But it was the first iterations of it were 1976. We actually had our bonded license under Ravenswood in 1976, but the world didn't see it until 1979.
Who are the owners? Who were the owners? Was it you and your wife, or were you married at that stage?
No, I wasn't married at that stage. I was the sort of the incepting winemaker and founder of Ravenswood, and very quickly took on financial partners. And in 1979, did a limited partnership and took on 15 limited partners who, you know, became friends and real supporters. I was in my 20s, and they were all in their 50s. So you can imagine, as we got into the later years of Ravenswood, they were much older, and I was still going strong.
So now you guys are producing, a million cases a year?
Yeah, very, very close to a million cases. Actually, 76% of what we do is Zinfandel. We also do Cabernet and Merlot and a tiny amount of Chardonnay. So we're primarily a red wine house. We look to be making big, hearty, full-bodied, robust reds that have style and character.
I've seen things saying, no wimpy wines, please, or something on there.
No wimpy wines allowed. Yeah, no wimpy wines allowed. It became sort of our moniker, or nullum vinum flaccidum, if you happen to be Latin and you're still alive.
But what about that flaccidum bit at the end?
Yeah, exactly. didn't want to go anybody to go there, or no vino sin huevos. It actually was a response to one of my partners coming to me and saying, look, you're making great wines, we're selling everything you're making, you're getting great awards. He says, but we're going broke, and we need a cash flow wine. And I suggest you make white Zinfandel. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't do pink and sweet and wimpy. It just doesn't happen here. And he actually went down to a store. In those days, we had to sell all our wine ourselves. We basically sold it a case at a time. And he was in a store, and the store owner said, I love your Zinfandel, but you guys are doing Zinfandel. You really ought to do a white Zinfandel. He says, you should come up with that. It's hot, And Reed said, well, I don't think that's going to happen. He said, Joel's adamantly opposed to it. In fact, he has a sign over the fermenters that says, no wimpy wines allowed. He just made it up. And that probably would have ended there, except Greg, the store owner, decided he was going to come to the winery. And he phoned me up and said, I'm coming. I want to taste your Zinfandels. I really like them. By the way, I want to see the sign. And I said, the sign?
Which sign?
Which sign is that? And he said, the one that says no wimpy wines allowed over the fermenters. And I said, oh, that sign, because I could hear that Reed had a way of creating things like that. And I thought, okay. So I phoned up Reed and said, what's this about? And he said, a bit of a story. And I said, he's coming up next week. We've got to have a sign. So by the time Greg arrived, we had a sign. And it epitomized what we did so well that we sort of latched onto it. In fact, other people latched onto it and became the moniker for Ravenswood because we make big, robust, full-bodied, high-character red wines.
When I see something like, say, no wimpy wines, you expect, a fairly big wine, but also, maybe a bit overblown in the alcohol department, man's wine sort of thing. Kind of drink a man's wine, it's got to be 50% alcohol or nothing. That's not your style, though, is it?
No, not really. Of course, men run the whole spectrum from being very sophisticated to being slovenly and slavish. We like to believe that our wines have character and style. It's not a matter of just being big. It's a matter of having the essence of where the fruit came from and giving you the best that fruit has, giving you structure, giving you intensity, giving you nice aromatics. But it's not about alcohol. It's not about necessarily just power. It's about expression.
The range that you've got, three levels in your portfolio. You talked about needing to produce a sort of a cash flow type wine. Right. And is that your Vintner's Blend?
That's Vintner's Blend. And Vintner's Blend is the one that we make the most of. I actually made 1,000 cases for my first production of Vintner's Blend. And it sold so well that I made 3,000 cases, thinking that that would last me forever. And, of course, it didn't. It went out very quickly. So it was a very popular wine. I was trying to make a good, solid red wine. I didn't want to make, white Zinfandel, and I wasn't particularly interested in making a white wine. I wanted to make a good, solid red that I could sell at when it was younger, that people would really like, and that they wouldn't have to, give up their firstborn to afford. Clearly, I've done it, you know, almost too well in some ways. That wine represents a fairly high volume, high percentage of my volume these days. It's probably 30%, 30 or 40% of what I do. And of course, we do other levels. We do the next level up, which are our county series wines, which are more focused wines: Sonoma, Napa, Mendocino, Lodi. Wines that come from a particular region that have regional flavors that are made in very traditional styles using, you know, open top fermenters and native yeasts and things like that. And then we have our vineyard designated wines, which are even more focused. They come from specific vineyards, which are the very best vineyards that I can, you know, make wine from. The vines were planted somewhere between 1884 and 1900, so that they're pretty remarkable old vines. They're low production, meaning, you know, a ton and a half to 3 tons an acre. They're made in very classic style, open-top fermenters, native yeast, French oak, about 35 to 40% new. So really classic wines, and very small lots. So we run the range from very large volumes to wines that only represent 500 cases or so. So we like to think of ourselves almost as three wineries within a winery.
Something I've been exploring with a few people as we've been doing these interviews is aromas that are in the native environment of the grapes, but not necessarily from the grapes. For example, there were some forest fires in Australia a while ago, and the grapes took on a smokiness to them. Another one, I was talking to one of the guys at Mount Difficulty in central Otago, where I'm from, is covered in thyme, so you can sometimes get the influence of thyme coming through the wines. Eucalyptus in some parts of Australia. Do you believe in that type of thing, and if so, do you have anything that might express itself like that in your wines?
Well, there's no question that the environmental factors express themselves in grapes, whether it be the soil or, you know, or just the microclimate of temperature and humidity. But there are also those external circumstances like eucalyptus, which I think is the one that, you know, pervades Australian wines. But there are other regions of the world where it hits, and California is one of them. As is South Africa. But there are some Zinfandels that show a little bit of the eucalyptus character. I have a vineyard-designated Zinfandel called Dickerson Vineyard Zinfandel, where there's a very, very large eucalyptus tree next to the vineyard. And you get that kind of minty, cedary quality that clearly comes from the eucalyptus tree. I've got another vineyard called Cook, which is surrounded by bay trees. And in most years, the bay doesn't express itself very much. But when you have an extremely hot fall, just before you pick the grapes, the bay oils will volatilize, and you will sometimes get a bay character in the wine. And then there is the fennel character that comes in another vineyard that I use on occasion.
Aniseedy type.
That kind of aniseed character. Yeah. Those are kind of the flavors that you get occasionally with these wines. It depends a lot on the year. It depends on the prevailing winds. There are a lot of things that go into it.
Sure.
Sometimes it's stronger than other times. But there are certainly these environmental factors that affect the wine.
Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing? It's almost like if I plant a couple of eucalyptus trees beside my vineyard, I can add some flavor to my wine. I don't know. I'm just exploring it, really.
Well, I don't know that it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's a matter of whether it's a fit, whether it's the right spice. I mean, you know from cooking that, you know, if you put the wrong spice in a dish, you can kind of just screw up the dish.
Yeah, sure.
On the other hand, a small amount of the right spice will make a dish very interesting. So in Dickerson's case, that eucalyptus is exactly appropriate for that vineyard. Within another vineyard, it might not be very good.
Okay.
And in some years, quite frankly, you know, the characters of bay in Cook Vineyard annoy me, you know. But they're there. They're part of the environment. And if I'm making wines that are true to their site, that's just part of the site. And it's part of, you know, what I take on as working with that site. And it's part of the interest of the wine, in fact.
It's interesting you mentioned food. Do you class your wines as foodie wines? You know, are you making Zinny to be drunk by itself, or are you making it to go with food? And if so, what sort of food?
Well, there's no question that I make all my wines to go with food. I grew up with a mother who was a nuclear chemist, but she was also an A1 cook. And food and wine at our house was was an important thing. And so I think of wine as being something that's paired with food. It's not something necessarily you drink to get drunk. As my father said, if you wanted to get drunk, drink vodka. It's a lot faster and a lot cheaper. So food for me is very important, and I do make my wines to go with food. I think that they serve as a really nice counterpoint, but also as a harmony with food in many cases. I build my wines with tannin, I build them with structure, I build them with really interesting aromatics. but I'd build them in a way so that they don't overwhelm food. They're not massively oaky. They're not sweet. They don't have a lot of the things that, you know, wines that people make for sort of like, you know, sitting around the fire and consuming, you know, or in a bar consuming, are headed for. They're wines that really are stylized for food. And the foods I'm shooting at, you'd have to think of them as being Mediterranean, I suppose, foods that have good spices and garlic and herbs and are rich and complex in terms of the way they present themselves, because these wines tend to be relatively robust. They're more in the realm of, Rhone wines or Northern Rhone wines, as it were.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good acidity,
spiciness, really, really nice fruit associated with it. Firm tannins without being aggressive.
Yeah. All right. I think we'll wrap it up there, Joel.
Great.
Thank you very much for your time.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for the interview.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Joel. Next week, we're going to be going deeper with Joel into Zinfandel and looking at a wee bit about Zinfandel, the grape variety, a bit about its genealogy, where it came from. So until next week, cheers. And good drinking.
The UK Wine Show was brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show was produced by Jane Scott and recorded and edited by Chris Scott. The news was read by Jane Scott and researched by Sandra Clement. The music for the UK Wine Show is Griff to Jingle 1 by Marcel de la Jatelle and Silence by Etoile Noire.